Did it look to you like T-shirt was about to go off? I was a bit nervous, it might explode. So just to say a little something about simplicity and attributes and how we come to know God, that question of bite-sized pieces is quite important. God, as he is in himself, is totally indivisible. And yet, you do not have a mind that is capable of being confronted with the entire reality of who God is and understanding. So God, in his mercy, lowers himself to our level and speaks our language. So he reveals things about himself that we can understand on their own. In other words, he reveals himself as though there were divisible attributes that we could take and look at individually. Does that make sense? So Calvin says, God talks baby talk to us because we're babies. Okay, so don't worry too much about about that idea of bite-sized pieces. Actually, that's quite a helpful thing as far as it goes, in that we have a concept of love and God speaks to us in those terms, in terms of the way that we've experienced it, in terms of the way. So God uses all kinds of metaphors to talk about himself in the Bible. You know, in the Psalms, God is a lion. God is a rock. It's using the language of human experience. It's using picture language to communicate something to us about who God is. Okay? So just recognizing that there is a sort of, there is the reality of who God is that you'll never understand sort of all in one bite. But God reveals things about himself that are all true, but are not in any way divisible from each other in reality. So we dive into looking at what some of these attributes are. Now you may not know this, but St. Helens as a church is signed up to the Southeast Gospel Partnership. And one of the conditions of being part of the Southeast Gospel Partnership is signing up to its doctrinal basis. And the doctrinal basis of the partnership begins with Article A, extraordinarily. And here it is. The existence of one eternal, immutable God, creator and Lord of the universe, who in the unity of the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit both governs all things according to his will and is accomplishing his purposes in the world and in the church. So it lays out a number of attributes of God that are seen as being necessary and right to be believed. So we're going to look at some of those attributes. And what I want us to see is that that is not a sort of arbitrary thing that St. Helens or people who want to be partnered in the gospel in the Southeast have come up with in isolation, that it's a sort of historical confession that lines up with what Christians have said down the ages. So I've got three reformed confessions for you on page one, i.e. three confessions that come from around the time of the Reformation. The 39 Articles from 1571... remains the Anglican standard of faith. So again, St. Helens has signed up to that. The Belgic Confession is sort of Netherlands and Belgium in 1561 and revised in 1566. And the Westminster Confession is, again, an English document, although massively influenced by the Scots, and remains the standard of faith for most Presbyterian denominations around the world, and in an adopted form at various independent churches as well. And that was written in 1646 in London. So two 16th century and a 17th century texts. And what we need is we need some readers, because we need to kind of capture the sort of the way in which these things are enculturated. So to read the first article of the 39 articles, I need someone who sounds stereotypically Anglican. Well, I thought, did you say Kev? Phil Young? Phil Young's babysitting, that is just... Okay, great, we have our Anglican. Do we have anyone sort of vaguely Dutch, Belgian? Are we going to have should we have a sort of who's the Dutchest fight, or... Adil? You sure? Okay, so, because I don't want to start a war or anything. So if you could read the Belgic Confession for us in a moment. And then, anyone Scottish here? Kevin? Who? Kev, that's great. So if you could give us some Scottishness in the Westminster Confession, that would be great, because they pulled all the strings. So, Ferdinand Articles.
There is but one living and true God, everlasting, without body, parts, or passions, of infinite power, wisdom, and goodness, the maker and preserver of all things, both visible and invisible. And in unity of this Godhead, there be three persons of one substance, power, and eternity, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost.
Thank you. Belgic Confession.
We all believe in our hearts and confess with our mouths that there is a single and simple spiritual being, whom we call God, eternal, incomprehensible, invisible, unchangeable, infinite, almighty, completely wise, just and good, and the overflowing source of all good.
Thank you.
There is but one only living and true God, who's infinite in being and perfection, a most pure spirit, invisible, without body, parts or passions, immutable, immense, eternal, incomprehensible, almighty, most wise, most holy, most free, most absolute, working all things according to the counsel of his own immutable and most righteous will, for his own glory, most loving, gracious, merciful, long-suffering, abundant in goodness and truth, forgiving iniquity, transgression and sin, the rewarder of them that diligently seek him, and withal most just and terrible in his judgments, hating all sin, and who will by no means clear the guilty.
Thank you. See, probably you noticed as we went through those things that there are points at which they differ or have slightly different emphases, but they have a basic core that is the same. And one of the things you should notice about that is that doctrinal statements do need to change. Not in the sort of central heart things, but there are different points at which the truth is under threat in different cultures and at different times. And those things need to be addressed in our doctrinal statements. So it's not a matter of changing our minds about what we believe about God, but about stressing different things sometimes at different times. But nonetheless, there is a basic agreement over a number of things. And I want us to just pick them up in Article A, what those similarities are. So the South East Gospel Partnership speaks of a God who is one, the existence of one God. And each confession stresses that too, doesn't it? The idea of monotheism, that there is only one God and that he is one. 39 Articles, there is one living and true God. Belgic Confession, there is a single and simple, remember that word, simple, spiritual being whom we call God. The Westminster Confession, there is but one only living and true God. That God is eternal, is picked up in each of the confessions. Immutable, perhaps not a word that is so commonly used, perhaps not a word that's so familiar to us, but immutable means unchangeable. So the 39 Articles, without body, parts, or passions. Go on.
What do they mean by passions?
Can we come to that later? We will come to it. So that's fine. So that's there both in the 39 Articles and the Westminster Confession. At creation, he is the creator and lord of the universe, maker and preserver of all things, visible and invisible, i.e. everything. The overflowing source of all goods, the alone foundation of all being, of whom, through whom and to whom. Glory is due. Triunity. This is a God who lives in Trinity. That's expressed clearly in both Article 1 of 39 Articles and of the Westminster Confession. It gets a separate article in the Belgic Confession. So it's actually stressed a bit harder in some ways. And this God is effectually Lord over everything he has made. And strikingly, that's one of the things that is most explicitly stated in the South East Gospel Partnership, isn't it? That he governs all things and is accomplishing his purposes. So, all we're going to do is work our way through them and see what each of them means and some of what they imply. So let's start with this idea of monotheism. Deuteronomy 6 verse 4, God is one. We saw it in Isaiah 40, didn't we? He is the only God. There is none other to compare with him. There is none other that even comes onto the same scale. He is the only God. But strikingly, this one God is not impersonal. This one God is a God who exists in Trinity. Now, we'll talk about this much more this evening, but just to help us at this point, I want you to see how the things we've talked about already begin to sort of coalesce and help each other. So the idea of simplicity is really helpful in terms of thinking about one God who is Trinity. So it's not that there are three separable persons that you could take off into three corners of the room and have different conversations with. God always exists as the Father begetting the Son and breathing out the Spirit. So it's not as though the Father is in any way, you can't cut the Trinity up into pieces. So there is one God who is three persons. There's never a time at which there are three gods, never a time in which there's one God in one person. From eternity past to eternity future, God is one God in three persons, indivisible. You cannot take him to pieces. Does that make sense? So simplicity actually really helps with that. Yeah, sorry, go ahead. Yes, thank you. That's an excellent question. Did everyone hear that? Okay, let me repeat it. If you say everything about God the Son, does that mean you're also saying, if you were to say everything about him, then you're saying everything about God the Father and God the Spirit? I think the answer I want to give that question is yes, but in a sort of qualified way, that if you describe God the Son in terms of everything there is to say about him, then you've defined the divine essence. In the early church, they said things like, the Son is everything the Father is, except Father. Okay, so everything that's true of the Father is true of the Son, except for the fact that he's the Son and the Father's the Father. So there's that idea of a sort of essence that's identical, and yet there's this relationship of different persons that are rightly distinguished from each other as persons. And if you said everything about the Son, then you'd have to say everything about his relationships with the Father and with the Spirit, which would mean, yeah, you'd said everything. So, yes, that's absolutely right. I'm sort of slightly struggling at the limits of my ability to conceive of things, but, yeah, I think that's very perceptive. As we've paused, does anyone else want to sort of put up a hand in the chat, help? Or are we okay? Yes?
What about when Jesus was on earth?
Thank you. Can we deal with that later? Great. Where's the nearest theological library? Now, I do have an answer to the question. I'd like us to deal with it later on, perhaps quite soon. Okay, so we're talking about Trinitarian monotheism. That's the point. So it doesn't mean that God is impersonal. That's very important. Nor does it mean that God is the only supernatural being. So the distinction isn't between sort of natural or physical and supernatural or spiritual. So, for instance, in 1 Corinthians 10, verse 20, Paul, in speaking about the worship of idols, talks about idols as vehicles for demons. There are other things in creation that are referred to and worshipped as gods that are supernatural, that are not physical, and that can do things beyond normal human experience. The distinction isn't natural, supernatural, spiritual, physical. The distinction is actually creator, created. So, again, we're going to talk about this tomorrow morning. But it's a very common misconception of the fabric of reality that there are two equal and opposite forces battling out against each other. That on the one hand you have God, and on the other hand you have the devil and all his angels, and that somehow they're a fairly evenly balanced opposing forces. But that's not right at all. God is the only God, and even Satan and his angels owe their entire existence to God as their creator. So it's not an equal and opposite forces thing at all. There is only one God. There are other things that are supernatural, that are spiritual, but that's not to put them on the same plane as him at all, because the distinction is between creator and created. And I think once you get that into your head, that actually really helps with questions of evil and understandings of who Satan is and those sorts of things. Okay? So, thirdly, we're not just told that God is one, but also we're told the implications of that. So can we flick to Deuteronomy chapter 6 together? And let me just read to you from verse 4. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your strength. These commandments that I give you today are to be upon your hearts. Impress them upon your children. So it's not simple information, but it's information with a purpose. God is one, and so we must love him and worship him, because he is the only God. Deuteronomy 6, verse 4. Or Isaiah 40, as we saw earlier, God is totally incomparable. He is the only creator. He is the only one worthy of the title of God's. There is nothing else that exists that is anything like him. So the Bible doesn't simply stress God's oneness, but then presses it on us. You may not, you cannot, you must not worship anything else. The first commandment is to love God and God only as God. Which makes idolatry all the more significant and all the more important as we think about it. If you think about the sweep of the scriptures, idolatry is a really important idea, isn't it? And because we don't live in an age where people bow down before carved statues, at least not in this country, at least not at the schools that most of us went to, nonetheless, that question of idolatry is a really significant thing. Because if you put anything else in the place of God, you're doing something really, really serious. You're telling lies. Firstly, you're telling lies about the idol. You're saying that the idol is comparable to the incomparable God. You're saying that the idol can offer you things that only God can offer you. Say, it's been really striking to me thinking about the sort of dreadful mess that our country seems to be getting into over money, and just thinking how many of my friends have seen money as the ultimate security, as the thing you could depend on to get you through. And I think about, you know, actually the sort of dreadful things that some of them are facing as a result. The idea that, because it's so tangible, isn't it? It seems so real. It seems like something that, when everything else fails, somehow you could rely on. That only God is someone to be trusted like that. You tell a lie about the idol and you tell a lie about God. Because what you say about God, if you worship an idol, is actually that he is comparable to other things. That he is not unique. That he is not the only one I should worship. That he is not the only one who deserves honour and glory, ultimately. And so you rob God of his rightful glory. If you put anything else in his place, you rob God. It's quite a striking image, isn't it? But it's the image the Bible gives us. To worship an idol is to rob God of his rightful glory. Which, let's remember, is what he created us for, ultimately. To glorify him. Say Psalm 78, verse 58. Let's just flip to it. Psalm 78, verse 58. It's exactly what he said about himself in Exodus 20, isn't it? They, that is, the fathers who are disloyal and faithless, angered him with their high places. They aroused his jealousy with their idols. Because God has been robbed of the glory that is rightfully his when it is given to an idol. So maybe it's actually something that spiritually we should think about rather more in terms of our relationship to God. Have I given God's honour to something or someone else? Have I treated something or someone else as though they could give me the things that only God can give me? So that I found myself in a position where to lose them or to lose that would be the end of the world. In other words, you've made them the ultimate thing that gives your life meaning. So that's monotheism. What about eternity? Boethius, who was around in the 6th century, wrote one of those books that the title just makes you long to read it, The Consolations of Philosophy. It's a page turner. But he defined God's eternity like this, and I think it's brilliant. God's eternity is the complete possession, all at once, of illimitable life. The complete possession, all at once, of illimitable life. Thomas Aquinas, the medieval theologian, put it in two words, actus purus. Latin's great, it's like Welsh. It's basically just English with different endings. You know that about Welsh? Isn't it? Okay, all right, what does bolio mean? Bolio. What's Welsh for golf course?
Of course, golf.
Okay, so... what's Welsh for no parking? Okay. Now, actually, Welsh is an ancient and wonderful language, and I was born in Cardiff, so, you know, I'm not being racist. But Latin is like that. So actus purus, what do you think that means? Pure act. The point is, there is no potentiality. There is nothing unfulfilled in God. So here's the thing about God's eternity. God possesses all of his life all at once. There is nothing that was his yesterday that is not his today. And there is nothing that will not be his tomorrow that is not currently his today. Isn't that a thrilling thought? God's eternity isn't actually the absence of something. It is the presence of everything. It's not the absence of time, but the fact that God is perfected in every respect. He's without need. He needs nothing to fulfill him. So there's the whole question that people have about what it means when the Bible talks about God being eternal. What does it mean? Is it atemporality, the fact that he doesn't experience succession, that time does not affect him in any way? Or is it the idea of what I've called eternality or sempiternality, which is the idea that somehow it's unending in passage through time, so that somehow God exists in time, but without beginning and without end? Now, they are actually very different ideas, and I want to give you two reasons that are just arguments for it, and then some biblical material. So, on the one hand, Augustine's argument for God being atemporal, not experiencing succession, goes like this. If God does experience time, that means he has a succession of ideas. He just has to have a succession of ideas. And if God has a succession of ideas, then in some respect he knows today what he did not know yesterday. And that means that there is knowledge for him to have tomorrow that he doesn't currently have. In other words, God is not omniscient. There is knowledge that can be had that God does not have. And God knows more today than he knew yesterday. And so Augustine says, well, we know that God is omniscient, so he must be atemporal. Another argument in favour of this comes from one of the traditional proofs for God's existence. There's a version of what's called, I'm not going to go into a huge amount of detail, but there's a version of what's called the cosmological argument that runs a bit like this, that it's basically an argument that the universe must have a beginning, and if it has a beginning, it must have a cause, and if it has a cause, that cause must be a personal cause, in order for it to have a beginning that is actually in time. So that's the sweep of the argument. But the bit I want us to focus on is the argument that the universe must have a beginning. And the argument goes like this. Let's talk about what infinity is. Okay, so really simple question. What is infinity plus one? Infinity. Okay, so infinity is a difficult concept, isn't it? I want you to imagine a library. Okay? And the library has infinity books in it, ranged around infinite bookshelves. And every other book is red, and every other book is black. Okay, so it goes black, red, black, red, black, red, black, red, black, all the way around. How many red books are there in the library? Infinity. Okay, what am I trying to demonstrate? An actual infinite cannot exist. Infinity is a really useful idea for mathematicians and theoretical physicists, I suppose. But it's not something that you actually could experience in the world of trees and rocks and people. So, according to the idea that God experiences succession, that there is time in God, but that it has no beginning and no end, in other words, it stretches back into infinity in the past and into infinity in the future, how many years must have passed before now? Infinity. Can you get to infinity? No. So, are we here? We can't have got here yet. Because you'd have to pass through infinity years to get to us. And you cannot pass through infinity years, because as long as there's potential for there to be future, you know, more in the future, you're not at infinity yet. In other words, we don't exist. Well, now, I take it that we do. So I suspect that we haven't been through through infinite years to get to us. In other words, the universe must have a beginning. Time must have a beginning in order to get to where we are now. I don't worry too much if that just seems a bit sort of boring. Okay, fine. So the point of the books in the library is that actually infinity is, in a sense, an irrational idea, in the sense that you cannot deal with actual numbers and deal with infinity at the same time, I think. So it's a fascinating concept, but when you try and make it concrete, it just blows up in your face, really. So it's just an illustration of how, in the same way, you know, in the past you've got to get through infinity years to get here, and that doesn't really make any sense. Is that okay? Is that great? Yes, absolutely. Thank you. Sorry. So atemporality means existing without succession, existing outside of time in a way that is unaffected by time. So temporal meaning time, a meaning without. Eternality is a technical word that means basically being within time but not having a beginning or an end. So affected by time in some way but not with any kind of beginning or end. So it's still infinite. And omniscience means knowing everything. So actually we'll come to omniscience later on. Thank you, I'm sorry, I should have explained that. Now, of course, because our language is entirely time-bound, it's very difficult to really talk about eternity in the sense of atemporality, because it's a concept that's slightly beyond our minds and certainly beyond our ability to communicate, because language is temporal. So you see the problem with Boethius' statement, the complete possession all at once of illimitable life. He can't stop time getting into his definition because of this idea of a moment in time. But the point being that from our perspective, as people who are bound by time, whenever we look at God, you'll see exactly the same thing. If you were capable of looking at God and seeing everything there is to see, in the sense that he is unaffected by time. So biblically, I do think that idea of atemporality comes through more strongly. So yes, we're told that God has no beginning and no end, and we might think that logically that means that he must be atemporal, but there is actually explicit warrant for thinking it. So Hebrews 1 verse 2. God is the one who creates the ages. So, in fact, the Son is. So in these last days, he's spoken to us by his Son, whom he appointed heir of all things, and through whom he made the universe. Now, the word that's used there for universe is the word ion, which literally means ages. Now, it's quite right to translate it as the universe, because it's one of those words that you can't translate directly into English, but it carries with it the idea of time and space, of all of creation. And so the idea is, I think, that God creates with time, that time and space go together. So if I'm no cosmologist and I'm no theoretical physicist or anything like that, but from what I understand from what such people tell me, that time and space actually have to exist together. You can't have one without the other, that there is a sort of that time comes into being with matter. And that somehow they're intimately connected. And that seems to be what's being said in Hebrews 1 verse 2. That actually God creates time in the same way that he creates matter. So God is not material either, as we'll come to. But in the same way that he doesn't have a body, he's not affected by time. And so Hebrews 1 verses 10 to 12... the big emphasis is on the fact that the Son of God is unaffected by time. So the heavens wear out like a garment, but you remain. They will be changed, but you remain the same. And your years will never end. So time doesn't wither God. It doesn't affect him in any respect, in any of the ways that it affects the rest of us. So time is created. That's the suggestion. So that relates in one direction towards simplicity and perfection, because if God does experience succession, does that affect simplicity? But as we'll see in a moment, it also affects the idea of God being immutable. In fact, we'll see it right now as we flip over the page. So what does immutable mean? Well, to be mutable is to be subject to change. And to be immutable is to be unchangeable. Say Malachi 3 verse 6. I, the Lord, do not change. So you, O descendants of Jacob, are not destroyed. And James 1:17. Every good and perfect gift is from above, coming down from the Father of the heavenly lights, who does not change like the shifting shadows. The one who made the sun and the moon is not like the sun and the moon. They shift in the heavens and they create different shadows, different light at different times. But God is not like them. He does not change. God is immutable. So what are we actually saying? Because this is one of the most frequently misunderstood attributes. We don't mean that God is immobile, that God doesn't do anything. That is how it's sometimes characterized. If God is immutable, then he must be immobile. But absolutely, we can't mean that, can we? Because God acts, he creates, he saves, he speaks. So the point isn't that he's immobile, but that he is utterly consistent in his character, and he cannot be changed out of that character by any external force or person. God is totally reliable. And actually, if you think about it, in terms of eternity, because these things are so closely related, in terms of talking about eternity, how do Boethius and Aquinas define it? It's pure act, possession of illimitable life. It's absolutely the opposite of immobility, isn't it? It's absolutely the opposite of being static. It's actually being perfectly fulfilled in action all the time. So it's not that God is not at all active, but that God could not be more active. Because he possesses all of his life, which is without limit, all the time. Time being, you know. So one particular threat to the idea of immutability is this idea of in the 20th century of process theology, that somehow God is coming into being. And it comes from this critique that an immutable God is so static that he cannot be involved with us. And there are all kinds of pressures on the guys who first sort of developed process theology to recognize the reality of change and progress. So there's ancient Greek philosophers like Heraclitus. Heraclitus is the guy who famously said, this is just, you know, to impress your friends at dinner parties, Heraclitus is the chap who very famously said that you never step in the same river twice, because all is flux. Everything is always changing. Nothing is the same from moment to moment. More recently, in the 19th century, Hegel speaks of history as a process of advance, of dialectical advance, from one set of ways of looking at things to another, from one way of being to another, and gradually history is making progress and moving forward. Things do not stay the same. And his philosophy goes hand in hand, at least in terms of time, with development of theories like biological evolution with Charles Darwin. And then imagine yourself at the beginning of the 20th century, or the end of the 19th century. What has the last century held? Well, human life has totally been transformed. The railways have been built. You can get round your country in no time. Everything's been mechanised. You've got electric light. You've got sewerage. It's almost like living in Roman times. But to someone in the 19th century, you think human history is advancing at an unprecedented rate. I don't think the Romans had electric lights, by the way, in case anyone misquotes me. But there are all these things that mean that you need to recognise the reality of progress and of process, that things change and things seem to get better. Now, that slightly got hammered by two world wars in the 20th century, but nonetheless, those philosophical pressures are there. So that initially it was developed actually by a mathematician called Alfred North Whitehead, but John Cobb and Norman Pittenger were more theologians who tried to develop this idea of God's being dipolar, that is, having two parts to it. So on the one hand, there is a sort of atemporal, primordial nature to God, and then there's what they called a consequent nature, which is basically the bit of God that can change. And within that is God's self-expression in creation and the world. The idea being that somehow God is able to relate to his creation in a way that takes proper account of its change and its process. So that recognizing the sort of philosophical need to keep some of God's unchangeability there, there's this idea of a sort of dipolar God. And so in some way, the universe becomes part of God's self-realization. Now, you may not have come across that in explicit terms, but actually it's one of those things that's amazingly commonly there under the surface when you really begin to scratch at what people are saying about God and what he's like, particularly as they reject the idea of immutability. So the idea is that really it makes God the great fellow sufferer, which is hugely attractive to people, isn't it? Because actually people suffer an awful lot. And the idea of a God who is unchanging suggests a God who is incapable of compassion, certainly incapable of empathy. It's attractive also because it gives the idea of God as one who persuades but does not coerce, that somehow he actually is part of the process. Did you see this article this week? Was it in the Telegraph? Archbishop of Canterbury, 9/11, you know, God is useless when we're talking about these sorts of things. This is the sort of thing he's talking about. I don't suppose for a moment that he meant to say that God is useless, but actually that God, like us, is at the mercy of these things. It's something that certainly comes out of process theology, even if it's not explicitly that. And of course, one of the great things that's attractive about it for us, because of the insufferably high view of ourselves we have as human beings, is that God somehow needs human cooperation, if this is true. That if the universe is going to go where it needs to go, then God needs our help. Now, we really, deep down, each one of us really wants to believe that. I think that's the heart of human sin, is us trying to reach out and grab God's prerogatives and God's position. That's the striking thing, isn't it, about God getting to name himself. Moses doesn't say, I think I'll call you such and such. God gets to name himself. And in many ways, one of the things I want us to, the big thing I really want us to learn this weekend, is that God gets to name himself. And that God gets to decide what God is like. And sometimes we will be confronted with things that we don't instantly like about God. Assuming that we're all sinful, we will be confronted by things that are true about God that nonetheless we find in some way distasteful. But God gets to name himself. And our right response as creatures, and particularly as those who have enjoyed and experienced the salvation that the Lord Jesus offers, is to submit to that and call God by the name that he has chosen for himself. And by that I mean, we submit to what he reveals of himself and don't say, do you know, I could never believe in a God who, or I like to think of God as. We need to be people who are marked by those who say, God tells me in his word that he is like this, and so I will worship that God who goes by that name. Go ahead.
On the previous page, on page 4, I think it is.
Yeah.
On the bottom there, this is not pantheism, but
pantheism. Yes, thank you. Okay, so pantheism is the idea that somehow God and the universe have got the same boundaries, that the universe sort of is God in some way. That's pantheism. Panentheism is the idea that somehow everything is in God. So the boundaries are different. There is more to God than the universe, but nonetheless the universe is in some way part of God, part of his self-realization. Thanks for pointing that out. Sorry, I'd missed that. Now, this idea of the God who is the great fellow sufferer, who persuades but does not coerce, who seems to need human cooperation, on the one hand seems attractive, but once you begin to look at it carefully, then you have a God who is, as Rowan Williams says, useless in the face of things like 9/11. Because he's not sovereign. And you cannot be certain that a God who is not completely sovereign will bring about his purposes for the creation. You don't know, do you, that the Lord Jesus will reign for eternity on earth if God isn't completely sovereign, because things might not go his way. What a terrible thought. What a terrible thought that the future might be uncertain. And how can I know for certain that a God who is not completely in control will save me? How can I know? Because one of the things that for me, as I've been a Christian 20 something years, and I think one of the things that each year becomes clearer and clearer to me is that I can't trust myself, but I can trust God in salvation. I cannot trust myself. I'm the one who got myself into the mess that God rescues me out of. But I can trust God, but not if he's not sovereign, not if somehow he's dependent on his creation. But what about the critique? Is it possible to speak of God being immutable and relational at the same time? Well, I think it is, and I'd like to give you just one example of it, and it's it goes under the heading of an argument that a change in relations does not signify a change in essence. What does that mean? Well, it just means this. Imagine, this is going to be hard, but imagine I'm the tallest man in the room. And then someone taller than me walks in. Have I changed in any way? Am I still the tallest man in the room? No. So my relations have changed, but my essence has not changed. Okay? So God's relations with people can change without him changing in the slightest. A change in relations doesn't signify a change in essence. I don't want to dig into that too hard, but just to see that it's not a nonsensical idea. Fine. Omnipotence. All powerfulness. normally understood to mean God is able to do anything. So, have you ever had that problem in sort of Christianity Explored? Maybe you've raised this question. Can God make an object that is too heavy for him to lift? Or, well, if God's all-powerful, can he create a square circle? Mark 10:27, with man this is impossible, but not that, but with God all things are possible, to do with the salvation of the rich. With God all things are possible. And so omnipotence has sort of, in a sort of folksy way, been understood to mean that God can do anything. And so we get ourselves into all kinds of trouble when someone asks about a square circle. We go, yeah, of course you can, or oh, I don't know, or my brain hurts, or whatever, fancy a latte. Anyway, actually, it is slightly more complicated than that, because the Bible tells us that there are some things that are impossible for God. We've already begun to see that, I think. But Hebrews 6:18, it's impossible for God to lie. James 1:23, it's impossible for God to be tempted by evil. 2 Timothy 2:13, it's impossible for God to deny himself. And understood biblically, omnipotence is stressed not so much on being able to do anything as to being able to do anything he wants. So God demonstrates his omnipotence in Genesis 1 and 2, his utter power, by creating just using words. Let there be light. And there was light. Let us make. And every time he says it, it happens. He just has to speak. That's how powerful he is. Whatever he wants to do, whatever he plans to do, he can do. So in Hebrews 1 verse 3, the Son is described as the one who literally bears the universe along on its course, sustaining all things by his powerful word in the NIV. But it much more literally means this idea of sustaining the universe on its course. Sustaining things in being, yes, but sustaining them where he wants to take them to. So God's plan and God's achievement match perfectly. Which means there is no such thing as effective defiance. You cannot fight City Hall. There's no fear that God's plan might fail. Say the doctrinal basis that we looked at from the South East Gospel Partnership puts it brilliantly. God governs all things according to his will and is accomplishing his purposes in the world and in the church. So when we talk about omnipotence, we mean that God is able to achieve what he plans and that no one can stop him and he doesn't need any help. He's able to act in complete accordance with his character, but he is not able to act in any way that contradicts his character. So, can God make a square circle? Well, ask yourself the question, why are circles circular? There's some way in which the mathematical rules that govern a circle being what it is are an expression of God's will and intention and character in creating. To put it another way, the law of non-contradiction is an aspect of God's character. So it's one of the sort of basic rules that underlies the universe because it's an expression of who God is. So it's just a ridiculous question to ask whether the God who made circles circular could make circles square, or to put it another way, that God could create two things that are entirely contradictory. Well, no, because he can't contradict himself. Okay, so we're on to things that aren't in the doctrinal basis, and we'll cover them at varying rates. Impassibility, so we were asked about this before, and it's rather like immutability. So to be passible is to be at the mercy of your passions, and to be impassible is to not be at the mercy of your passions. Now, let me tell you why it's been considered important. And I've learnt this lesson in whole new ways since I've had children, and particularly a three-year-old daughter. I don't think she'd mind me telling you this, but when we moved to Oak Hill and her and little sister Harriet was a few weeks old. Miriam, who was 2.5, came toddling up to Sam, my wife, and said, can I have a biscuit? And Sam said, no. So Miriam thought for a moment, looked at Harriet, and said, I love my little sister. Can I have a biscuit? God cannot be manipulated. You cannot so play on God's emotions that you get him to change out of his character, to do something that is not in accordance with his will. Does that make sense? That's why it's been considered important. Because a God who is passible is at the mercy, in some respects, of his creation. Now, what it doesn't mean is that God cannot feel, that God is impassive. God feels things powerfully, doesn't he? Read Hosea 1 to 3 and tell me that God has no feelings. Read Genesis 6, verse 6, where God looks at his creation and his heart is filled with pain. God is not impassive. It's not that he doesn't feel anything. It's not that he doesn't respond to his creation. But nonetheless, he is not mastered by those feelings and he is not mastered by his creation. So a passion or a pathos, classically speaking, is something that is external to you, that controls you, particularly emotionally. So it's not that he can't be, that he can't feel, but he's not mastered by what he feels. He cannot be manipulated. Because a God who can be manipulated is not truly king. It's one of the terrifying things, isn't it, in The Lord of the Rings, where you've got, is it Theoden who's the king? And actually, he's not really in charge. Because Grima Wormtongue, is that the right word? Is that the right? Yeah, yeah. Is really the neck that moves the head. Is really the one who's putting poison in his ear and getting what he wants done. And he is a servant of the evil Saruman, ultimately. So, a God who can be manipulated is not truly king. Now, that is something that we've slightly lost contact with, I think, even though it's in the DB. And losing that, we have found ourselves slightly off the rails in historical terms. And this is something I'd like you to be able to consider in your groups in a moment. And it's the final paragraph of this section on impassibility. And this is what I used to teach when I worked with students. If I ever gave a talk on the cross, if I ever wanted to really tug on the heartstrings of people, when I talked about the cross, I would talk about the fact that at that moment when Jesus dies, there is a rift in the Trinity. And that the Eternal Son and the Eternal Father are separated from each other. Now, if I had said that in the 3rd or 4th centuries, I would have been excommunicated. And indeed our creeds guard against it. Because from everything we've seen, we know that God can't change. That God is not able to suffer in that sort of way. And that God is simple and indivisible. If you introduce a split in the Trinity at the cross, it's not just a relationship that you sever, but actually the fabric of reality. Because suddenly you've made God divisible. You've made God changeable. So in some way we need to be able to speak of God the Son dying on the cross as a person, but not in his divine nature. And that's one of the emphases on the incarnation that you find regularly in the early church, and it actually becomes a sort of trump card that gets played in debates on the nature of the incarnation. That I don't want us to talk about now, but we will talk about it before the end of the weekend. But what I want you to look at and talk about and think about in your group is the question and the objection that I've raised to that idea actually an important one? Does it really matter that what we think over here and what we think over here match up with each other? Does it matter that what I think about who God is in his eternal nature and what I think about the cross don't contradict each other? Is that an important thing? And think about them in the light of God's eternity, God's immutability, the fact that it's impossible for God to die, God's simplicity, those kind of things. Okay? So that's your mission. That could or could not be lots of fun. Go ahead. The question again. Oh, goodness. So basically, does it matter whether or not we think there's a rift in the Trinity at the cross? Is that a discussion that's even worth having? And what would that mean in the light of the other things that we've said about God's nature? Is that clear enough as a question? No? You have another go? Leonie understands. In all seriousness, does that make sense? You can discuss that? Yeah? Okay, good. And I'm very happy to chat with you over lunch or whatever, having logged that particular grenade out there. Okay, so quickly moving on. Omniscience. So in Psalm 139, for instance, the emphasis on God, so omniscience, knowing everything, emphasis on God as the eternal creator of all means two things. One, that he understands the universe entirely because he made it. So there's nothing that's independent of him. And so he knows what it will do. Now, here's another thing you can talk about in your groups if you like. That is something that people don't like so much anymore, because if God knows everything, that means he knows the future. And if he knows the future, that must mean that I have to do what I'm about to do, which means I'm not free, which means I'm not responsible for what I do, which means it's all God's fault, so I can do what I like. That could be an interesting discussion. I want to say that neither the second or the third point actually flows out of the first one. And there's a bit of a key to unlock it for you. So let me just give you an illustration of why omniscience really does imply that. So when God creates the universe, I want you to imagine that basically there are an infinite number of possible universes that God could create, assuming that he knows everything that's going on in them. So God's in heaven, and he doesn't have a body or anything, but just imagine for a moment that, you know, he sort of takes every possible creation and looks at it. And he knows everything. He knows we're going to have this conversation. He knows it will be sat in this room on this day. And he looks at every possible universe, and he knows everything that will happen from beginning to end of that universe. And he chooses to create this one. Actually, just even in that act of knowing and choosing to create, there's a sense in which everything that happens in the universe is already determined, isn't there? Because God knew it before he did it. Okay, so it's an implication of God's omniscience that there is a sense in which he superintends every single human action. And yet the Bible tells us that we are responsible, and in a sense at least we are free and we have our own intentions. So if that troubles you, go to Genesis chapter 50 and take it seven times a day until you get it. Now, if you flip onto the last page. Sorry? 50 verse 20, thank you. If you flip onto the last page, time and again, the idea that surfaces, doesn't it, as we look at the attributes, the idea that surfaces is closely tied to the idea of monotheism, that God is independent and incomparable. So God's unbounded or unrestricted with regard to time, power, passion and knowledge. And these things all play back towards simplicity, don't they? God is perfected and without need. Now that's true in terms of what people have classically said about God being immense, that is without boundaries. That's literally what immense means, without boundaries. And incorporeal, that is without a body. He doesn't have edges. He is not constrained by physicality, by space or time. So what we've seen is a God who is astonishingly and breathtakingly huge and powerful and unbounded and can do whatever he wants. And no one can stand in his way, and he needs no one to help him. Now on their own, they would simply be terrifying, wouldn't they? It would simply be a terrifying thing to even think about living in his universe. And yet alongside all those things, and we saw this in Isaiah 40, didn't we? We're told about God's moral characteristics, his moral attributes, his faithfulness, his holiness, his mercy, his kindness, his gentleness, his love. And these things, in talking about God's attributes, are often summed up under the headings of goodness, or the heading of goodness. And the thing to note about all of those attributes is this, and it's very simple. They are relational. Love can only be fully realised within a relationship between persons. Kindness can only be expressed in a relationship between persons. And so the question that arises is this: is God perfected before he creates, or does he need a creation in order fully to realize himself, so that he can fill those unfulfilled attributes? And we're back, of course, to process theology. Or we go to the doctrine of the Trinity, which, astonishingly enough, is what we're going to do this evening. So well done for staying with it, well done for keeping the earplugs out and not having the sleep of the century, most of you. So three questions to think about in your group. The question of omniscience and God's control, the question of the Trinity, and perhaps more devotionally, to think about the fact that God gets to name himself. That God gets to define who God is. Why not talk and pray through that as you finish in your groups before we go to lunch? Okay.